WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He's gone from stand-up comic to TV's most popular dad. My guest is Bill Cosby. In his stand-up act and on his sitcom, childhood has been his favorite subject. Now he has a new book of stories from his own childhood. Cosby grew up in a Philadelphia housing project. He had no show business contacts to help him get started. He didn't even get to see comics perform. He was too broke to ever buy a ticket and too afraid he'd get caught if he snuck in. The people he now thinks of as his comedy teachers are people he never met. People he knew only through records and books.
Two situations freed me up. The records that I bought and listened to later in the 60s, Jonathan Winters, 2,000-year-old man, Lenny Bruce and Red Fox, and they all and Lord Buckley, they all had something in common, and that was that the joke did not come in the first 7 seconds, which is what everybody was saying. You have to be funny in the first 7 seconds, but none of these people did that. So it freed me up. It's sort of like a painter, and you really don't have all of your skills down pat, but you know that you want to paint and you have an idea of how you want to paint. But if you don't see anyone else doing it that is considered good or a master, then your particular idea is dependent upon how much strength you have in continuing your own want and your own philosophy. So hearing these five people gave me the incentive to stay on course with telling stories. I loved Mark Twain, and I think that was largely due to the fact that my brother Jimmy and I, after our mother bathed us, put us in the bed, and then she would read to us, and she would read Mark Twain. We didn't get the little rabbit that put the eggs out. We didn't get the little engine that could. I mean, we got Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, Connecticut Yankee. So I loved it. And then I listened to my grandfather. My grandfather, paternal grandfather, had the greatest way of telling stories. And I think, in fact, I am today part grandfather, paternal, and part my father, and physically my mother. And so I drew from these people.
Physically your mother?
Yeah.
How so?
Facial expressions and physical attitude.
So I'm curious what you got from Red Fox, and I ask that since he was so well known for his you know, blue humor, and your routine was always really clean.
Red's intonation, his ability, the different way that he told a story. See, Red is the material may be blue, but Red in essence was a storyteller.
What was the step for you right before you started performing? You know, what was it that made you realize, well, I could probably do this?
I was always dabbling. And people would say, you know, you're funny. You ought to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And my answer to them was, right, just walk right up. I think a part of what kept me from really taking it seriously was because you're looking at the 50s and the 60s, and you're looking at no Negroes wanted here. So there was nothing really that gave me a feeling that I could. And since I had not played the Uptown Theater and didn't, I mean, you have to be a tremendous star in order to go to New York and play the Apollo. The jazz clubs didn't have stand-up comics. There was really no place that had a sign saying that Negroes could come here and do stand-up comedy. I think the commitment came when I had all of my academic world set, my athletic world set, and then this show business world. I could toy around with that and not be super, super serious about entering the area. So first, while at Temple University, was to become the best junior high school physical education teacher these kids had ever seen, and to save all of them from themselves. Number two was to perhaps delay the teaching career and play pro football as a defensive back. And number three was to tell these jokes. So while at college, I played three sports, was on the dean's list, and then in the evenings to supplement my mother's and father's checks, I took a job as a bartender at a place called the Cellar Bar. It was Broad and Spruce, I think it was. And that's where, mixing drinks, I would tell the customers, we would trade jokes, really. And I'd get tips from that. It was a white Englishman and his white wife, who was English also, became regular customers. And then one day he said, I was telling a fellow at a club called the Gaslight in Greenwich Village about you, and he wants to give you a job as a comedian. And so I said, okay, thank you.
So that's where it started for you, in the Village?
Absolutely.
And that was a place where there wouldn't be obstacles created by your being black?
No. When I went in, the job description was fantastic. The guy said to me, I need somebody to break up the monotony of the folk singers. So that freed me up right away. I mean, so, you know, after these people sing about the wind called Mariah and the Dust Bowl and going fishing, et cetera, and the falsetto voices, and after they stood there tuning up, I could never understand why folk singers didn't tune up in the back and then come out front. They always came out and stood there for a good 10 minutes tuning up in front of the audience. So when the folk singer would come off, and my job actually was to introduce the next folk singer, I had 10 to 15 minutes, and I would do any number of routines.
So you did really well as a comic, and eventually ended up acting. I think your first real acting job was co-starring on the TV series I Spy, where you were an undercover agent playing with Robert Culp. This was the first dramatic series to star a black actor, I Spy. The first non-comedy series. You wanted to know about the script before you would sign on. What kinds of things did you want to know?
I wanted to know how they were going to treat the Negro. I certainly was not going to be a black joke. And I certainly was not going to be afraid of ghosts. But let me tell you, first of all, that the fellows, the writers, David Friedkin and Mort Fine, along with Sheldon, I never had a problem with them at all. If anything, they made Alexander Scott a super, super, super hero. Guy was a Rhodes Scholar, spoke seven languages, et cetera, et cetera. So there was never a problem. I just wanted to see the script to make sure, because I had done a show prior to I Spy called That Was the Week That Was, and it was comedy, and I was the only Negro on the program. And some of the scripts that came through, I never did some of those routines because the jokes were always about my color. And I said to the writers, I'm not doing it. So finally, one of the writers came out. I said, well, why aren't you doing these jokes? I said, well, these jokes are all about, they're on me, and they're about my color, and you guys are not writing anything to counter. I don't counter this person's statement to me. And if it is funny, then why can't I say this about the white guy?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Cosby. He's written a new book called Childhood. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Cosby is my guest. When you started The Cosby Show 8 years ago, did it feel like it was going to be momentous in any way to have a sitcom about a black upper middle class family? Did that feel like it was going to be groundbreaking? I'm not talking about the ratings, but just in terms of what television shows.
First and foremost was not the color. First and foremost for me was getting the control of the family back into the hands of the parents.
I mean, as opposed to the shows where the kids are always the wise guys and get the jokes and are smarter in the long run.
Yes, exactly. And I felt that this was leading to a horrible image for parents and would be detrimental to children.
I read somewhere that someone in the network wanted the character of Cliff Huxtable to be a chauffeur.
No, nobody on the network. I said that.
Oh, you said that.
I said that. Nobody in the network said that. I said that. Well, and my wife said, that's not a job I want to see you with. But I don't think anybody really understood the reason for it, my reason for it. Some people felt, well, here you are, you know, being a servant again. And I said, no. To me, if a guy owned his own car, if he put his money in and bought a limousine, a Lincoln, and he polished it every day, man, and he had clients, and he was hustling, and he was on the go, this would show that this was a working man and an entrepreneur at that.
Well, what changed your mind about the character being a chauffeur?
My wife said she felt that it he would look like a servant no matter what. And then Marcy said, I don't think that the United States of America will accept you as a chauffeur. So I said, okay.
Do you think that the series is any more realistic than, say, Father Knows Best or Ozzie and Harriet? And here's the reason why I ask. You know, so much of the time, you know, the parents are on the couch or in the kitchen, either, you know, cracking wise with the kids or just being wise for the kids. And, I mean, although they have these really high-pressure jobs, they never seem to have to work or really bring that pressure home. They just have unlimited time for the kids.
Yeah. I don't remember Archie Bunker. He would come home. But I don't remember seeing Archie's job. Fred McMurray sat around. I mean, it's a prototype.
Mm-hmm. Your attitude is that's just the way sitcoms are.
I think that my attitude is that we were going to do a sitcom. The difference would be in the attitude that the parents had towards the kids compared to what I had been seeing over the past 5 years. Now, whether that got into this father knows best or whatever, I don't know. I don't think people change that much. I think that even in coming up with ideas that happen to come from my experience in life or something I had just seen or something that happened in my home with one of my children, even that story, and I think a great deal of it has to do with writers. I have a problem with sitcom writers, some, because they are called writers, and they have this arrogance within and about themselves, and it's not healthy, and it isn't good, because if you're called a writer, then that means you're paid to sit down or stand and think, which, as far as I'm concerned, many of the writers that I had didn't do their job. They reached back, they grabbed old jokes, they tried to force old situations, and I constantly came with ideas that I thought they were fresh. And obviously, it was a problem for these people. The other problem is that most sitcom writers are dedicated to the joke first. And you've got to really suspect somebody who can write a joke, have someone say it, and then the writer presses the button and laughter comes out of a machine and they say, "That's funny."
Right.
You've got to suspect those people.
It has been written about in some publications that you have been estranged from your second oldest daughter. And I wonder if you feel that that's put you in a very awkward position as, you know, television's wisest dad to have a serious problem in your own family that has been made public.
No, not at all. I never said to anybody that I was America's father. Some writer decided that would be a good hook, and I don't think it was anybody out of my public relations firm, I'm pretty sure. However, just being a celebrity would cause something like that to go public because you are a celebrity. Your kid goes out and drinks too much one night, and it is Cosby Kid.
So, if you don't mind my asking, are you on a better relationship now with your daughter, or would you care to not discuss that? Or
we are on the same wavelength that we've always been on. Erin is our daughter. We love her very, very much, and she has her own way of living the life that she wants to live. And as she gets older, this way of living, whatever it is solely her choice. It's a matter of how she wants to live. But we have four other children, and would you like to hear about them?
Sure.
No, you don't either.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Cosby, and I should mention he's written a new book called Childhood. I know that a lot of people wonder why, when you've been so successful, do you still continue to do commercials on TV? So let me ask you that.
I ate Jell-O pudding when I was the smallest of, and I made it. I made Jell-O pudding. That was a dessert. Lower economic. I drank Coca-Cola when I was a kid. These things were really sort of like heroes. Driver Ford. Lower economic people look at, well, I did anyway. I looked at these things and I heard the commercials, and they were big. So when people came and said, you know, we'd like you to represent MB, I mean, that was just as important to me as doing I Spy.
So do you know when the last Cosby Show taping is going to be?
Somewhere around the end of March, I think, yes.
And are you looking forward to the end?
Yes, because that's the show we're going to do, the doorbell.
The doorbell?
See, there's something that I'm in love with this year, and that is a running gag. Cliff is trying to fix the doorbell, and the doorbell does not ring.
Oh, right. It rings funny.
Yes.
It rings like it's got a sore throat or something.
Yeah, it's, yeah. And different ways. Yeah. And different ways. And I love that. And I would love to tell you, you know, what's going to happen, but I think it would ruin it for you. But something's going to happen to the doorbell.
Right.
Lisa Bonet is just fine, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
My guest has been Bill Cosby. He's written a new book called Childhood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.